In nature, a wildfire is one of the most devastating natural forces. It burns hot and fast and leaves little behind but ash and char. Or so it seems. Very soon after the fire passes through the forest, life returns. Shrubs and weeds that clog the forest floor have burned away, leaving space for new trees, grasses, and flowers to emerge and flourish. Habitats are created, bringing new insects, birds, reptiles, and mammals. A cancer diagnosis can feel like a wildfire, our bodies becoming this new, fire-clarified landscape. For some, cancer changes utterly everything. For others, cancer brings greater clarity and purpose. And some of us are still searching for what life after a cancer diagnosis will look like. Welcome to The Burn. We are exploring stories of life and transformation following a breast cancer diagnosis. I'm April Stearns, the founder and editor of Wildfire Magazine and the host of this podcast. Today, we are going to hear a love story. A story of finding love after a breast cancer diagnosis. But not only that, a story of finding love after a metastatic diagnosis. I'm so excited for you guys to hear this one. My guest today is Kiara Riga. She is a marketing operations manager who was diagnosed at 27 with stage 4 hormone positive breast cancer. Kiara was originally told that her breast lump was only a cyst and that she was too young for it to be breast cancer, only to be diagnosed with MBC with extensive bone metastasis a year later. This cancer diagnosis has taught Kiara what is most important to her, which is spending time with her loved ones and her dog and traveling and seeing more of this beautiful world and spending as much time exercising and out in nature as possible. She lives in Santa Cruz, California, and spends her weekdays working at her tech marketing job during the day and exercising however her body allows in the evenings. Her weekends are spent hiking with friends and her dog, paddleboarding, taking short adventures to nearby towns, and she was recently getting into surfing. When she has time off, she works toward her goal of seeing all 63 U.S. national parks. Welcome to The Burn, Kiara.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, welcome back. You've been here before. I'm so excited to have you repeating with us.
I'm stoked to be back.
Thank you. So today you're reading a piece that you wrote called I Thought All Love Was Off the Table. We published this in the 2023 Love and Intimacy issue. After you read, you and I will chat. Those of you listening, stay tuned to the very end for a writing prompt inspired by today's episode. All right, Kiara, I'll let you take it away.
Sounds good. When I graduated college, all of my closest friends were in serious relationships, some even married. I was always the odd single one, but I had chosen a different path. I was raised by first-generation Canadians whose parents came to Montreal on a boat from Italy with nothing but the clothes on their backs and the dream of better opportunities. My parents had modest upbringings and often helped my grandparents at work when they weren't in school. They instilled in me a sense of responsibility to work, to save money, to make financial stability my top priority. There would be time for the frivolity of dating later. And so as I watched all of my friends get married and start their new lives as part of a pair, I married my work. I was making six figures before age 25. At age 26, I was recognized as one of the best in my field. I was closing in on my goal of buying a home with only my income before the age of 30. I was living the life I thought I was supposed to live. Then cancer happened. Like a mirror falling to the ground before my eyes, I watched all of my dreams shatter as my oncologist said the words, "It's spread to your bones." I wouldn't survive the cancer, so why would I continue spending all my time trying to climb the corporate ladder? I wouldn't survive the cancer, so why would I buy a home only to leave my family with the responsibility of a mortgage that would likely outlive me? But the shattered dream that saddened me the most was the dream I had of finding my person. I had spent my whole adult life working, just like my family had always told me was most important. But what was I left with? A healthy 401k I wouldn't live long enough to use, a house fund that would likely be put toward medical bills or given to my brother when I'm gone, and a loneliness inside me that I was sure I would never be able to fill with a life partner. After all, what man looking for a serious relationship would sign up to be with a woman who would likely not live to age 40? What man would knowingly sign up to be a widower long before retirement age? I tried dating apps and even met a few men from the apps in person, but once they found out about my health, the conversations became less and less frequent until they exited my life altogether. I didn't blame them. If the roles were reversed, I can't say I would jump at the opportunity to be with a man whose years left on earth could be counted on two hands. So I resigned myself to a life of singledom, my dog Scout as my only life partner. I watched my friends pass milestone after milestone and cheered them on while each one grew the ache in my chest that longed to live those milestones too. And then I met David. We met at a mutual friend's wedding and hit it off right away. We both love the outdoors, national parks, travel, and Taylor Swift car sing-alongs, and our personalities couldn't be more similar. I tried not to get too attached, though, because there was no way he would be interested in a romantic connection with me, given my incredibly short lifespan. When he asked me to spend a day together a few weeks after the wedding, I said yes, thinking it would be just a friend thing. Our hangout was a few days before my birthday, and when he picked me up, he brought me an incredibly thoughtful gift and gluten-free brownies he had made for me from scratch. From that day forward, we spent at least one day every weekend together, and against my better judgment, I started falling for him more and more. I thought I was destined for heartbreak, but the happiness he brought to my life felt worth 1,000 heartbreaks, so I continued to spend time with him. Then one night, we were talking on the phone and ended up expressing that we had feelings for each other. I was shocked that he would feel the same way about me. Why would he want to be with a terminal person? Later that night, I expressed my fears about cancer, my prognosis, and how I feared that it would affect our relationship. I expected him to want to take a step back from us to find someone with a longer life expectancy. Instead, he wrote words that I'll never forget, words that brought me to tears. Just because you live long doesn't mean you're happy or your life is meaningful, etc. It just means that unfortunately, if we can't cure you, you will leave us a little bit earlier than the rest of us, but I will be so happy to know we really had something real. Before he sent me this message, I don't think I knew what it was like to be so loved for every part of me. Some of my exes loved me for what I looked like, or my body, or the promise of the life we could have together. David loves me for who I am, for every part of me, both good and bad. He makes me a better person and showed me a love I thought I'd never get to experience in this lifetime. Our relationship isn't without struggles, of course, and cancer is a big one for us. The first time we kissed, I ended up with an infection that landed me in the emergency room with a neutropenic fever. And coming from a traditional Chinese family, telling his parents about my diagnosis has been a struggle for both of us. But whatever life throws at us, I know that we can conquer it together because we are both so all in for every part of each other, both good and bad. I don't know what the future holds for us. Maybe, hopefully, I'll get to live my dream of a wedding and we'll sail off into the sunset. Or maybe we won't be each other's forever. But whatever happens, I'm grateful for the most selfless man I've ever met, showing me a love I could only dream of during a time when I thought all love was off the table for me. Like he said, we have something real, and I'm the luckiest girl in the world to get to experience it for however much time I have left.
Yes, yes, yes to all of that. Oh, thank you so much for that story, Kiara. It was beautiful.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to let you catch your breath. I don't know, take a sip of water. We'll hear a quick testimonial. And when we come back, we'll dig in. Hi, friends. There is now a wildfire book in the world. It is a big, beautiful compilation of my favorite essays from Wildfire Magazine, spanning all the way back to our first ever issue in 2016 up to the summer of 2022. This book took years to create and is literally the resource I wish I had had when I was diagnosed with breast cancer. This book is called Igniting the Fire Within, and it's made up of 50 essays that really dig into the experience of having breast cancer in our 20s, 30s, and 40s. Every stage of breast cancer is represented, from DCIS to stage 4, from all sorts of walks of life, from all around the world. Our writers go deep and get vulnerable to heal their own experiences and to let others like you know that you're not alone. You will find yourself within these pages. Get Igniting the Fire Within, stories of healing, hope, and humor inside today's young breast cancer community on Amazon in paperback and for Kindle now. Curl up with it today.
Hi. My name is Vanessa, and in 2021, I was diagnosed with breast cancer at the age of 44 in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. I read Wildfire magazine and attended a wildfire writing workshop. This led to my story being shared in the magazine, and it felt relieving and inspiring to share my story. Before finding Wildfire, I was struggling with cultural discomfort and isolation. But now I feel like a trailblazer to finally speak about hidden shame so publicly.
All right. Thank you so much for the love, Vanessa. Love that testimonial. All right. Turning back to you, Kiara, thank you again for your beautiful story and your vulnerability in sharing it.
Yeah, of course.
So you wrote this a little while ago. You and I are now recording in January 2024. Those of you listening, it's probably March or April. So Kiara, can you give us a little update since you wrote this story?
I can, yeah. I actually wrote this well before the article was, or the call for essays was due. I just like had an urge to write and it kind of came out. And so since then, David and I have gotten engaged. We live together, me, him, and Scout in a cute little bungalow, walkable to the beach. And yeah, everything's going really, really well.
I love that. Do you guys have a date for the wedding?
October 19th.
Okay. Well, the countdown is on, not so much now, but by the time people are listening to it, we might be 6 months out. So I'm very excited for you guys. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So yeah, I guess like you just mentioned that you guys are now living together. So maybe that's a good place to start. I know that before you moved in together into your little bungalow, you were living with your parents, and a lot of people with MBC do, in our community at least, do end up living with their parents. And so I'm just wondering kind of how that transition is going for you guys, maybe how it's going for your parents, you know, any fears that maybe kicked up, or is it all great?
Yeah, I think for the most part, it's really, really good. He's a nurse and he works 12-hour shifts, which means he only has to go in 3 times a week. So for the majority of the week, he's here and he's able to do a lot of like the caregiving that my mom used to do, right, with like cooking and cleaning and whatnot. And then during the days that he works, I'll just cook an easy dinner and just kind of do as little as possible, but try and take care of him as much as I can. And that's worked pretty well for us. So we haven't really had any big struggles. I guess the only thing is like when I'm having side effects and want help and it happens to be a work day for him, it can sometimes get a little bit tricky, but yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think, and I might be asking you to put words in her mouth, but I'm assuming your mom was probably your primary caregiver in your home sense, you know, before. And I know probably what you needed from her varied depending on various things happening. Do you think it's been a little bit of an identity shift for her?
I think so. She's like every week, like, hey, can I bring over some meals? Even though we like go to the farmer's market and do like a meal plan every week and all that stuff. But yeah, I think she's just right now shifting towards how she can help with the wedding. But once that's gone, I'm curious how things will go for her.
But I kind of like that you have the wedding on the on the to-do list, because then she can switch her focus a little bit there. Having something to do is probably helpful.
Right, exactly. I'm like right now, my dress arrived and it was way too small, even though I sent my measurements. And so I need some extra fabric. And she's been like running around town trying to find extra fabric to bring to the seamstress, which is awesome because I work full time and I don't have time for that.
Exactly. Perfect. I love it. So, okay, so switching back to more of the story that you just shared with us, you know, you called it, I thought all love was off the table. And so I'm wanting to talk a little bit about things, you know, that we assume are off the table for us, depending on various life, you know, stuff happening to us, body stuff happening to us too. And what it's been like to have hope kind of come back onto the table for you. And if this experience with David has maybe opened up hope in other areas for you, or kind of where you're at with those things now.
Yeah, I mean, at first it was just such like a mindset shift. I kept waiting for like the other shoe to drop of like, he's going to get bored. You know, once it's no longer the novel thing, is he going to get bored of like having to be what I need from him, which isn't what, you know, normal 30-somethings want to have to deal with, right? But he has not gotten bored. And I think that's really helped me kind of be excited about more things. Like when I was first diagnosed, it was like, okay, I don't plan anything more than 3 months out unless it's refundable. And now like we've got a trip to Europe coming up in like 4 months, and we planned it months and months ago. You know, I feel like I'm more willing to let myself just like be excited about things, because sometimes even just the excitement of it is like better, like more, I don't want to say more exciting, but like I feel like it's more, sometimes it can be more fun than the actual thing, you know? And so just being able to like have that time to plan things and to feel like he's going to help me get there, that's another big one, right? Like if I'm normally traveling with friends and we plan a hiking trip and then all of a sudden I get, you know, sick and can't go, or I have lower stamina and can't hike as well, my friends aren't going to want to like switch gears and not hike the trails we had planned to. But David, because he's part of a partnership with me, just wants to experience things with me as much as both of us can. And so he's always happy to kind of shift our plans. And that also has been really, really lovely.
Yeah, I bet. It really sounds like a true partnership in that sense. That's incredible. I'm kind of wondering, you know, a lot of people that I talk to about, you know, love and relationships after diagnosis, a lot of people either are already in a relationship when that diagnosis comes along, or they might still be dating, or, you know, here and there, things are, you know, different situations for different people. But I think you guys have a really interesting opportunity with the fact that your illness was already known when you guys met. And so you could, from the very beginning, be having conversations about kind of the integration of caregiving, for lack of a better word, into your relationship, because I think that's really challenging. So how do you guys manage that and not lose your identities as partners in your relationship when it comes to the cancer stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really great point. We always talk about like if we met before I was diagnosed, I don't know that we would be dating still, because I am not the person that I was before I was diagnosed. And so I think just that identity shift alone would have made things really difficult. But beyond that, like we've made a very conscious effort to try and support each other through it. So if I have a scan and he happens to be working that day, we have a conversation the night before of like, okay, when-ish do you think you'll be able to take your breaks? Do you want me to call you? Do you want me to text you? Like I ask his input as much as he asks mine, because we're both going through this and we're both experiencing emotions. We're also both in therapy and both have kind of people in similar experiences that we can speak to. He's been matched with a mentor via after breast cancer diagnosis, ABCD. They're a fantastic org that I met my best cancer friend through. So that has been hugely helpful for him as well. And so I think it's just like from the very beginning, we've been able to be intentional about how cancer comes into our lives. And, you know, there was a point where kind of it was all consuming for me, and like we could not have a single conversation without talking about cancer. And so his therapist suggested that we do like weekly or daily or however often it makes sense, like check-ins where we don't talk about cancer otherwise, unless obviously something big comes up, but we have a check-in that's on both of our calendars that we can both, plan to talk about whatever concerns that we have. But outside of that, we're living our normal lives to the extent that we're able. Of course, it's always an underlying theme, but not talking about like the mortality of it and all of those kinds of things. And that's also been really, really helpful.
I bet. Yeah. I mean, even in relationships where maybe metastatic or chronic illness isn't a factor, we still have difficult things happening in our lives. And sometimes our partners get broadsided when we're constantly bringing up that hard thing. I know that's the case in my marriage, where sometimes my husband will feel like I've just ripped the carpet out from him because we were having a great dinner and all of a sudden I'm talking about, you know, whatever, fill in the blank thing. And he's like, where did this come from? Why are we talking about it? So I love that advice that your therapist gave, where you have designated time. No one has to feel ambushed. And my husband and I have done that. But we've also found doing that, then when there's times outside of that time that we're talking about that hard thing, I can say, can we talk about this? Or can I just talk for 5 minutes about this thing? And then he has permission to say yes or no. And so it's just like helped us create those boundaries, I think, around difficult conversations.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's so important. Like, I'll never forget, this kind of came about because we went up to San Francisco for a day and had like a lovely date day. And then we go to Neiman Marcus for afternoon tea. And I don't know how I got on the topic of like mortality, but like it ended with him crying at the table. And I was like, I can't be doing this. Like, I can't be doing this in public, you know? And so having kind of a container for it has been really helpful. And we need it in varying degrees. Like, we don't always do check-ins. Sometimes we're able to just talk about things, but it's more just being kind of conscious of each other and intentional about how we communicate and what each other's going through and what we have the capacity for in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I think another aspect to this caregiving is the balance of the fact that caregivers need care too. And, you know, it's not only the person living with the illness, although that tends to be the louder conversation, perhaps, or the one that's like, you know, got all the appointments on the calendar and it's like visibly the big thing that's happening. But I really feel strongly that caregivers need support. And I mean, it sounds like David is getting the support he needs. I just wonder, have you found that you need him to have more outlets, or is it, I don't know, does it feel balanced right now?
Right now it does, but it took kind of a breakdown. Like, he was getting so depressed. And so, because part of it for us is David's a nurse. So he's a caregiver in his work and when he comes home, and that's really hard. Obviously, he doesn't have the same emotional attachment to his patients, but even still. But he kind of went through it going, yeah, I have a therapist, that's fine. But he doesn't have anyone in his life who understands what it's like to be in his shoes. And so that kind of led to like a slow deterioration of just his mental state, right? He was kind of feeling really alone and didn't have anyone to talk to about what he was feeling. And it led to kind of like a full breakdown for us because I needed him. He wasn't able to be there in the way that I needed him. And that's kind of what led him to trying to find support groups and mentors and things like that, that I had been pushing when things were good as well. Like, hey, let's have this so that when things aren't good, you're already in, you have a rapport. And that didn't happen, but that's fine. We got there eventually. And yeah, I mean, I always say that I think the job of a caregiver is honestly harder than the patient, because the patient, we've got, like you said, the appointments on the calendar. We've got a list of everything we need to do and we just need to show up and do it. And obviously doing it is really effing hard, but watching someone that you love so much go through something so difficult, not being able to do much of anything, not being able to talk to people about it, like, to me, that's infinitely more difficult.
Well, and then also when you add in an illness that not a lot of people know a lot about. I mean, David probably had a leg up being in healthcare himself already. But as you mentioned in your story, you know, he's got a family who maybe didn't understand metastatic illness as probably a lot of us. If we got into a relationship with someone who is dealing with a stage four cancer diagnosis, I think the general public just doesn't totally understand what that means or that it's an ongoing situation. Can you talk a little bit more about, you know, trying to educate family and that part of this relationship?
Yeah, I mean, his family was especially difficult because we have a language barrier there. They don't speak a ton of English and I speak no Mandarin. So that was sort of difficult. And the first time that they heard that I had cancer was before we even met, actually, which was difficult. It just kind of had to come out in a conversation they were having, and they didn't approve at first. It was, you know, a lot of the traditional Chinese, like, if she's not able to give you a child, it's not, like, worthwhile. But then also a lot of just, we're worried about what's going to happen to you when she's gone, right? And so for us, it's just been a lot of kind of, they don't need to know the ins and outs of the disease. I am lucky in that my story has been published in a couple of different, you know, outlets. And so we shared the more, like, we translated the more hopeful ones. And sent that to them so that they could kind of understand, like, okay, here's the reality, but here's the life that I'm living now. And then it's a lot of, like, sending them, you know, photos of us out hiking or out with the dog and things like that. And they're, I mean, as far as I know, they're super understanding now. And it's, you know, we're doing a Chinese tea ceremony at our wedding and his dad's going to pick up my dress when he's in China. Like, they're so warm and welcoming. They got me, like, a lovely Christmas gift this year. And it's, you know, they've really come around on it. But it is so difficult at first. But I think part of it is, like, the statistics and things like that are important for the patient to know. They're not always important for the family to know, especially at first. Like, I think it's important to give them, okay, high level, here's what is really key. And then kind of, but here's how it affects me and my day to day and things like that.
Exactly. You know, as you were talking, I was thinking about my own daughter. She's only 15, so that we're nowhere near this. But, you know, if eventually she were to, you know, fall in love and become engaged with someone who, say, had a metastatic illness, I can imagine, you know, that that would be hard as a parent to know that there might be heartbreak coming, you know, and grief coming. And that would be hard to initially be open to. But I love the approach you guys have taken with educating them, like you said, picking and kind of choosing a little bit in terms of what information is pertinent, but then really highlighting the good, because, you know, no one has any guarantees. I know we get told this all the time, and it's a little different when, you know, you have this diagnosis. But honestly, we can't guarantee that our children will not have heartbreak or have difficult relationships. What we want is for them to find love and happiness in today, like in these moments, you know, in between. And so I love that you guys are highlighting that and that they've embraced you, obviously. That's awesome.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. So our time is running short, and anytime that you and I chat, I love to get an update from you on your goal of the national parks. I know there are 63 of them, so give us the update. Where are you at?
I'm at 14 right now, and we've got 4 booked this year. Would have been more, but the wedding is eating up all the money and time off. So,
wait, you're not getting married in a national park?
That would be the dream, but very difficult.
I would imagine. So where are you headed to this year?
This year we are doing Death Valley in a couple of months, Crater Lake in July, and then Grand Tetons and Yellowstone in September.
I love that. Do you have, okay, last question, but do you have any like quick kind of in a nutshell advice for anyone who's living with metastatic illness who has maybe been a little afraid to travel or put things on the calendar, like you said, you know, things that maybe require a little leap of faith and maybe setting yourself up for having to make changes?
Yeah. I mean, I think the best way is I started with things that were drivable and then booked only accommodations that could be canceled up to very close to the date, right? Even if it was an Airbnb, looked for good cancellation policies. And so that kind of helped me go, okay, like I'm not going to be losing huge sums of money here if I can't go, but if I can, this is an awesome trip, right? We're lucky April and I both live in the same kind of area where we have a ton of stuff that's really drivable. But I think there's a lot of hidden gems just about everywhere in the country if you really do some digging and find somewhere cool. So I think that's kind of the easiest. And then beyond that, I would just say, once you get comfortable doing that, maybe start with, okay, I'll fly there, but it's still a refundable Airbnb or whatever. And kind of ease yourself in that way. Just make sure that the people you're traveling with are understanding of your illness. But I would also like talk to your oncology team about what can happen if you've got a trip booked and there's, you know, something else comes up. Like we were able to, I was going to Banff and then I had progression and they really wanted to get on it right away. But we were able to make it work so that I did my mapping the day before my flight to Banff. And then I got back on like a Friday and then that following Monday started radiation and it worked out fine, you know, and my oncologist always tells me like you plan life around cancer and not the other way around. And I think as long as you're able to, I have found that advice to be really wonderful.
I love that. I think too, you know, just building in some recovery time, like everyone needs that. And so I think there are certain things that, you know, maybe when you're feeling down or you're feeling like you have to make certain accommodations because of illness, it might be helpful to remember that, you know, travel is taxing for everyone and everyone has periods of having to switch gears because of whatever happening. Like it's not all because of illness that things happen when traveling. And so I don't know, I guess I'm just trying to give people permission to feel normal too, if you have to make changes or like you said, accommodations.
Oh yeah. I mean, I've found that too. Like I'll get home from a trip and I'm exhausted and I'm like, oh, I hate this. But then I look over and David's napping on the couch because he's just as exhausted. You know, like I think sometimes we view life through the lens of our cancer and it's not necessarily like other people might experience things in exactly the same way.
Exactly. Yes, I'm talking to you after a weekend of travel and I am exhausted. So yes, yes to the naps afterward, no matter what you're facing. Oh, Kiara, it's been so nice talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us today and telling your story.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So I know that a lot of people probably already follow along with you, but will you say your Instagram for those who don't already follow you?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's Kiara versus cancer. That's C-H-I-A-R-A V-S cancer.
Perfect. We will link to you in the notes. All right. So you guys have been listening to me, April Stearns. I've been chatting with Kiara Riga. If you haven't yet read her story, I do definitely recommend looking it up. There's beautiful pictures with this piece as well. So it was called I Thought All Love Was Off the Table from our 2023 Love and Intimacy issue. And we have a few love and intimacy issues at this point. So if you like the theme, check those out as well. And as you know, you've been listening to The Burn. The Burn is a production of Wildfire Magazine, where we share breast cancer stories from young people like you've never read or heard before. We also strive to inspire you to write your story like you've never written it before. Stay to the end for a writing prompt inspired by today's episode. Our producer is Bill Smith of Shoe Production, and our production assistant is Monica Haro. If you want more on the life-changing transformation to be had from telling your breast cancer stories, please visit us at wildfirecommunity.org. You'll find a copy of the issue shared in today's episode. You can find all of our archives there, and you can take a writing workshop with me. There's no place on the planet like a wildfire writing workshop, and I want you to experience it for yourself. Discover how to write your way back to yourself, write your way to reclaiming your body and your story, and don't forget to subscribe to The Burn and listen to it wherever you go. Okay, here is your writing prompt inspired by today's conversation. The prompt is, what have I taken off the table since my diagnosis? And what would it look like to put hope back on the table? So what have I taken off the table since my diagnosis? And what would it look like to put hope back on the table? Set your timer for 8 minutes, write without stopping, see what needs to come out and where it will take you. And if you find that you write best with a good prompt, I've got oodles for you over at wildfirecommunity.org/free. Head on over. Happy writing. Thanks for listening. Until next time, take good care.